Welcome to the Government Services Chapter of the American College of Emergency Physicians podcast. GSASEP represents emergency physicians who work in the federal government, including active duty military, National Guard, and military reserves, as well as the Veterans Administration, Indian Health Service, and other federal agencies. Our mission is advancing emergency care for America's heroes. In this podcast, we bring you lectures and conversations with leaders in federal emergency medicine to help you better care for your patients and lead your departments. The views expressed on this podcast are personal views and do not represent the views of the Department of Defense, any branch of the military, or the federal government, and they do not constitute endorsement of any product by any of these entities.
Is the emergency physician and OIC in charge of the Special Purpose MAGTAF, which is the Marine Corps shock trauma platoon that was in direct support of 2nd Battalion 1st Marines, and subsequently was also in support of BLT-18 because they were co-located with us down between Abbey and Eastgate. So in direct support in a forward role one capacity outside of the normal North HKIA area. And we did quite a bit of evacuation care.
Afternoon. Again, I'm Rod Fontanet. I was the CCAT theater director out of Ramstein, Germany at the time. I was there deployed already on a regular six-month deployment, and then the Afghanistan evacuation happened. The majority of the missions we were doing prior to that day were mostly COVID NPC missions, picking patients up downrange that had COVID-19 and transporting them in the NPC throughout theater and any other thing that would happen prior to that day. And then things like drastically change the days from that day forward for the rest of my deployment. So happy to chat about it.
Thanks. I'm Travis Callahan. I'm an EMPA. I was an EMPA on the trauma team at HKIA Role 2, and I was also the triage officer throughout the time there at Kabul through the suicide attack and the days before that.
Great. So the first question here for the group is, diving kind of into lessons learned, what was one of the greatest lessons learned for you during this event?
So when I first got to HKIA, I started setting up the triage system, and my whole plan was planning for a mass cal because the writing was kind of on the wall, and we knew we had the intel threats that something was going to happen. So I put up trauma towers outside to kind of have an A through E for your March algorithm ATLS set up so people could go right to a cabinet, grab what they needed. I planned for a 30-person mass cal. So the biggest lesson I learned was when you're in a situation like that and you are planning with your consumables for TCCC supplies, over-plan three times and have things that are necessary and get rid of things that are unnecessary. You don't need size extra small gloves outside. You should have large. You should have plenty of tourniquets. You should have plenty of Krike kits. And combat gauze, that kind of stuff, was my big takeaway from the triage aspect of that day.
I think for me, from the CCAT side of things, so normally, prior to COVID, there are always three CCAT teams that are deployed in Germany at Ramstein. When COVID happened, the Air Force increased the number of CCAT teams that were there. There were the regular three deployed, and then they increased to an additional three specifically in theater for COVID transports only. Right before my teams and I got there, they sent, I think, one of those teams home and made all five teams that were CCAT teams remaining all COVID teams and just regular operations teams. So when we got there, we all could do COVID transports and non-COVID transports, which were great, right? So, but once Afghanistan happened, they sent an additional four teams there, right? So now I have nine CCAT teams that I have to kind of be over in addition to the CCAT teams that are in Qatar much closer to the fight, right? So just being able to move all those resources and making sure that everyone is on the same page and have a good essay of what's going on was huge. That was the first thing. Second thing, and I say this from the very beginning of this mass count thing, I was like, quite often when these things happen is the pediatric patients that are really, really heavily affected, right? But what's one thing that CCAT doesn't do that much of? pediatric transport, right? Because that's just not what we do. Our smallest ET-tube was a 6-0, right? In case we needed to, like, crike somebody for whatever reason, right? I transported a kiddo that was 2.5 years old, 8.5 kilos. That 6-0 ET-tube just was not going to work. We had zero pediatric supplies, right? So that was a huge gap in coverage that we had that we noticed very early on, right? And so, and as we go through this, we can talk about, like, how did we work to fill those gaps? But I think that was a big deal. And also the team composition, right? So I was the only, I believe, EM doc on the team, right? And then we had an anesthesiologist with a pulmonary critical care doc. And this was the five teams that were originally there. And then we had, I think it was another like general medicine critical care, right? So I was the, out of the group of the five of us, I was the only one that had any pediatric like comfort, right? The other ones was like, I haven't dealt with a kid in like forever since like residency training, right? And so that was another thing. Even if we had supplies, how comfortable is my team or my teams with even taking care of these really sick kiddos, right? The team in Qatar picked up a kid. This kid was, I want to say, 5 years old and intubated. When was the last time you had any of these pulmonary guys like set tidal volumes and things on vents, right? It's just, it was difficult. So those things we had to work through very, very quickly. And again, as we work through this, we can kind of talk about some of those lessons learned. Yes, sir.
How many CCAT teams does, let's say, the most limiting O-plan
call? How many for that?
Let's say a China or a Russia ballpark. Let's not get to
That I don't know.
238. How many do you have?
Not 238. I know we're trying to wrap up now, but I know we don't have 238. Yeah, see? Yeah.
It's a problem. Thank you, sir.
I have a lot of lessons learned from generally the entire operation, so I'm not going to go into all of them during this talk. I have a talk on Sunday. But I think the most important lesson looking back, and especially after that sucker punch from Captain Deaton, the biggest thing I can take from that experience is being engaged with your operational leadership in the planning, in the phase zero timepiece of all of this, while you're planning to plan. We thought we weren't even going into Afghanistan. We thought we weren't going to have to do an evacuation. I mean, from the top down, that was the messaging we were getting from our operational leadership. That being said, being engaged with them put us in a strategic position at the time to best support the sickest Marine that survived the actual blast. I had a very public disagreement, friendly disagreement with my CO more than a month prior to the event about where we would be located should we go into Afghanistan. And his position was, I want you at the role two. I want you at the role two. I don't want you close to the Marines because I don't want you to get hurt, your team to get hurt. And so we came up with a compromise after a little bit of back and forth. We had similar personalities. And after a bit, I said, sir, we're there to support your Marines in that case that they can't make it that 15 minutes around the flight line. There may be a time that there is someone who's so significantly injured that they wouldn't be able to survive that ride. And unfortunately, I turned out to be right in the situation. Not that I wanted to be, because again, this is a horrible situation. But there was one patient that came to us, and many of them bypassed us at our role 1E, we're calling it, because they went straight to the role 2, where fortunately there were five trauma teams available right there at the role 2. But the corpsman knew we were located a quarter of a mile from them. And so when they had someone who was peri-arrest and, you know, they didn't have oxygen, they don't have any tools, and they expertly, the corpsman expertly recognized that this patient needed help and knew where we were. So bought him the extra half an hour or whatever it was that got him to the operating room. And again, that's a credit to that corpsman who recognized that that patient needed help and that he found us in that moment. So being engaged operationally is the key, I think, to take from all of this. If you aren't engaged with your operational leadership, and that goes across the board, especially in these joint environments where we don't have this like purple model yet, you have to know what the operation looks like, what your plans are, and integrate fully with the Marine Corps for us or other operational line leadership.
Can I ask you a hard question?
Yes, sir.
Harder or easier because you're a woman?
Can you clarify? What do you mean by harder, sir? I had the background and strange honor, and I hate bringing this up because it feels like every time I have a conversation about this, this comes up. I was the first female battalion surgeon for 1st Marine Division back in 2012. So I went with 3rd Battalion, 11th Marines at that time for a two-year tour and kind of got used to the environment of the division line background. So this deployment, because I was female, wasn't as a large deal to me because I'm just used to that back and forth and just integrating and being myself, despite the fact that, you know, Marines have, especially line, division, background, have their own mentality about women being in combat. I think it was harder for my nurses and my fellow emergency physician. This was her first operational tour at all. Understanding that they may treat you differently, Marines, especially, for example, sir, I think what you were getting at is my CO wanted me to be at the role two, and I had a team of 5 female officers and half my corpsmen are female. And pushing back on that, I think partially that may have been because we were a group of women. He didn't really want us to be close to combat. But that being said, I had this argument with him, like, we are there for your Marines. If I can't be there for your Marines, who's going to be there? And so laying that out and just being firm about it, I think that that kind of helped quite a bit, but yeah, there are a lot of operational challenges being a woman with the Marines. And it's just one of those situations that you get used to, and I think eventually the Marines will change as we've integrated more and more females. Maybe, maybe not. I've seen a difference, though, at least seeing now, like, female enlisted with the infantry. I'm like, oh, wow, that's new. But yeah, it's a different situation. I don't know if I answered your question completely, sir. Yes, sir. The boldness is a big piece. And it's saying, he like flippantly said, well, you are the subject matter expert. I said, yes, sir, I am the subject matter expert. And this is what I said. And we left arguing with each other. And I did what I wanted to do because at the end of the day.
I think a take home point from what I'm hearing from you, Admiral, and from you is by being at those operation planning meetings, you have to be able to speak their language. Mm-hmm. So just as we have to talk to each other and communicate with each other on, you know, when you go and do your presentations in the hospital, you have to be able to speak a different language to the line. And if you're not communicating with words they understand, and maybe simpler if it's the Marines and more intellectual if it's the Air Force, just kidding, come on, the Army just kind of goes with whatever, if there's enough of us. But I think that's really important. So I think that is an important thing to know. You know, you said, like, hey, if you want me to treat your Marines and your guys, I need to be there. And so, like, I think that's something that we should highlight here, especially for some of the residents and, who haven't had the opportunity yet to interface with the line. Treat it like a foreign language, and you've got to learn their language because you can't speak their language. You're never going to get any changes. And then going to Admiral Hancock with policy change, if you can't speak their language, you're not going to get any change. So. Great point. Kind of talking a little about lessons learned, you mentioned some of the challenges. What was the greatest unexpected challenge that you faced during this event?
I feel like I've been. I'll let you guys take the microphone.
Again, the two for me were the lack of pediatric supplies and then making sure we had enough blood available, right? Because we didn't know what we were going into leaving Ramstein. So what we ended up doing was we worked closely with the blood bank there at Larmsey. And every CCAT team that lifted out of there heading downrange, they left with a Collins box full of blood, right? Because we just didn't know what all we would need. So, and it helped out tremendously because there's quite a few patients that ended up getting transfused. As a matter of fact, when we went and did a tail-to-tail with the team that was at Qatar, so they went to Kabul, and then we lifted from Ramstein, and we all kind of rendezvoused back at Qatar. We got the two patients from them. I got one off the plane, and then we actually went into the hospital at Qatar and got the second patient. We ended up having to transfuse the patient that we got from them. So, again, just making sure you have adequate supplies. What I did on the pediatric side was, I remember when I was with Tackett back in Africa, Djibouti, we had like these blue, kind of like Braslow bags, like pediatric bags, right? And so when all this started to spin up, I was like, why can't we just find those PD Braslow bags, right? And no one had, I went to the loggies, they had never even heard of these things. Typical loggy speed. It was like, can you give me an NSN? I was like, where you have? I'm going to pull an NSN from. I don't have an NSN just readily available. So we went to Larmsey to get another patient. And as I'm walking through the ICU, what do I see on their code card? The blue Braslow bag. I was like, that's the bag that I need, right? And so I called the folks, I think it was a Peds floor or whatever it was, and I asked for one of those bags. And so they said, we have one bag in the SIM center that we can just give you. I was like, perfect, right? And so the guy was like, but everything in it is expired. I was like, doesn't matter. Just send it. Right now I have no supplies, right? And so what do they do? Before he brings the bag, he empties everything out of the bag and just brings the bag with just empty purple and pink and red and yellow empty pouches. I was like, this helps a lot. I was like, so then the loggie was like, well, do you have the pack-out list that goes in each pouch? I was like, again, dude, where am I going to get this information from? So I reached back to Leslie Wood, Colonel Wood, back with AMC, and I was like, ma'am, I found the bags that I need. Can you get me these bags? And she was like, I'm on it. Within the next few days, AMC had like rush shipped us like three of those bags. My respiratory therapist and I, we built two bags out of stuff that I just felt needed to be in each one of those bags. And then every team that lifted to go downrange left one of those bags in. I made sure we had enough ET tubes in each one of those bags, that we had nasal cannulas that was for pediatrics, non-rebreathers that were for pediatrics. We had everything that they could possibly need. I found LMAs. I got with anesthesia folks over at Larmsey. I was like, I just need a bunch of pediatric LMAs, right? And so they hooked us up with everything we could possibly need in those bags. I found vent circuits that we could put, because, right, if you're going to put them on the vent, I can't use an adult vent circuit, right? So I had to go find vent circuits. So we found all those things to make sure those teams are ready. And then we actually had put together a bunch of didactic sessions, right, for us to just get together with our AE colleagues to say, okay, now let's talk about vent settings on pediatric patients. Let's talk about resuscitation in pediatric patients, so that all the teams that went to go pick these patients up, they were ready. So that was one of the big things we did. Another thing was, so there was this kiddo, right? And so Larmsey, they don't have a PICU. Right, so what they did was they found like these two pediatric docs. I forgot which hospital they came from downrange, but I think from Lakenheath, and they brought them up to Larmsey to staff like their makeshift PICU. And so that was this really, really sick kiddo. She was, I think this little girl was, I think she was the one that was 2.5 years old and about 8.5 to 9 kilos, right? So a lot of them were very malnourished, right? She had blast lung. She was sick, right? She was intubated. And so they called CCAT and was like, hey, we have a patient that needs to be transported back to the stage to Walter Reed. Like, okay, we'll come round and see the patient. So the CCAT team goes, and it was anesthesia provider was the doc on that team. So they get to Larmsey, they're looking at the kiddo, and they log roller, right? And when they log roller to get an x-ray, her sats dropped to the 50s. And they wanted them to take her tomorrow, right? And so her sats dropped into 50s. And it took about an hour for her to re-recruit to get back to where she needed to be. And so they were like, nope, she's not ready. She is not safe for flight, right? And they were like, well, I don't understand how you as CCAT feel you can deny transport. And she was like, because this patient's not safe, you can't even log roll this kid without her sats dropping into the 50s and staying there. Altitude doesn't make that any better, right? So it's basic physiology, right? And so they was like, fine, right? And so this thing blew up, right? This one star got involved. I mean, it was just, this idea was horrible, right? And it was like, finally, there was like, okay, fine. AMC got involved, and it was like, if CCAT say the kiddo can't go, kiddo can't go. So then they transferred the kid off base to Hamburg, right, to their actual PICU. So the following week, my team's up now, right? And I was like, shit. So my team's up now, and they're like, hey, this kid's ready for transport. I was like, ah, we fell for that once. I said, I want to go see this kid, right? So my RT, actually my whole team and I, we get in the car, we drive 20 miles. It's about a 20-mile, 30-minute drive to Hamburg. We go to the PICU, we see the kid, right? Kid's on clonidine drip, a midazolam drip, on a ketamine drip, and something else they had this kid on, right? And I was like, well, at least she's sedated, right? And so I was like, there's that, right? And so I was like, she looks good, but they always look good on the hospital van, right? I don't transport with the hospital van. So I was like, all right, we're going to go back to the base, get our 731, come back, connect the kiddo, and see how she does on our van, right? And so again, none of them speak English, so trying to like communicate this back and forth, it was like, I was like, we'll be back, right? So we leave, go get the vent, we come back, we get the kiddo on our vent, we get a blood gas, she looks great. I look at the team, I was like, I think we can do this. It's like, yeah, I think she's ready. So it was like, all right, we'll be back tomorrow, the flight, because we also had patients at LARMC. So it's just working out the timing piece, right, to get those patients from LARMC to the plane while we're working on getting this young girl transported on an ambulance back to the base. So we get to the hospital in Hamburg that morning, right? We put her on the vent on the settings that she had just did great on the day before, right? We get her on the vent, we wait 20 minutes, we get a blood gas. Her pH was, I want to say, 7.1, and her PaCO2 was like 120-something. And I was like, I don't understand what happened, right? And so if all things were still the same, it's just like less than 24 hours ago, how'd she get so much worse, right? And so, and this were kind of us as the ED docs, right? This is what I tell the residents, like, we have to be comfortable with that vent, right? Because on the Air Force side of things, our respiratory therapists by name, right? We call them cardiopulmonary technicians, right? Not all of them are created equal because not all of them are dealing with vents every single day, right? And so, and we have to be comfortable managing that vent because they're going to turn to us if they don't know what to do next, right? And so we get on the vent, RT looks at me and he was like, I don't understand what happened. Like, I went with the exact same settings I had yesterday, and she is significantly worse, right? And so I was like, all right, so let's kind of start doing. So we start, he and I started adjusting the vent. And right as we were adjusting the vent, the Hamburg physician pops her off the vent, squeezes like a whole thing of saline down the tube, and just starts bagging her, right? And so my RT's like looking because the vent's alarming, and he's like, what the hell is like? And he looks at the kiddo and notices that she's not on the vent anymore. And he looks at me like, she just de-recruited everything that she had. Like, why would he do that, right? And I was like, just let it go and we'll deal with it, right? And so we get her back on the vent, and I'm still confused as to what happened. So then my nurse walks over, and as he's now trying to get the drips transferred over, he's like, remember this little girl's like 8.5 kilos. He looks at me and he says, so hey, doc, do you want to keep this LR going at 100 miles an hour, or do you want to change that? And I was like, I think I know what happened. I think I know what just happened. And I was like, you gosh, to be kidding me, right? And so as the doc on the team, now I have to make a decision. Because if we package this girl up and put her in the back of that ambulance, she's ours now, right? And she wasn't safe for transport before, but I know that once we leave Hamburg, LARMC has made it extremely clear we do not want her back here, right? So once we leave, we can't go to LARMC. And so I jokingly said, I mean, we'll just turn around and come back. And that Hamburg nurse was like, nuh-uh. I was like, oh, you do speak English. Oh, you do speak perfect English. She was like, you ain't coming back here. I don't know where you're going from here, but I know you ain't going. You ain't coming back here. So he and I continued to adjust the vent, and we got everything to kind of turn around, right? So I started Lasix. We started diuresing. I adjusted the vent. And finally, we looked at each other, and I was like, I think we're ready. And I think it's going to be a sketch flight, but I think we're going to be ready. And she did great all the way back to Walter Reed. I even called to check on her, and all went well, right? So I think one of the biggest takeaways is we have to be current and confident with pediatric stuff, right? Because pediatric CCAT teams don't exist anymore, right? It's us now, right? It's the regular adult CCAT teams. And in these contingencies, when these things spin up as quick as they do, quite often, it's the kiddos that kind of get rolled into this, right? There was another kid that we transported that she was just one of the regular evacuees. She wasn't even a medical evacuee, right? And so she got loaded up on a C-17 with all the other evacuees, and then they had to get screened and have screening vitals as they went through the kind of their in-processing tent at Ramstein. But when they put the pulse ox on her, her stats were 50, right? And so they was like, well, that's usually not good. So they got her over to LARMC, and she had a univentricle. Right. And so we also with CCAT had to transport her back to the States. When I went in the room, she wasn't even in the ICU, she was just in a regular room. When I went to pick her up, her SATs while she was chilling in bed was 60. And we were there to pick her up to put on the back of C-17 and fly to the States. And I was like, Well, that's she has to go. I mean, there's nothing that we can do for her here. She has to go back to the States. Her mom took her off oxygen and walked her to the restroom when we were flying. When she came back, put on a pulse ox, her sats were 32. I was like, yeah, you're gonna just pee on the litter from this point forward because you're not coming off this oxygen anymore. I mean, so these are the things that you don't think about because we think combat. I'm like, I'm deploying for SeaCat, so I'm gonna transport a lot of sick adults. And in these contingencies, especially like when you think about the things early on, we're just trying to get people moving, these kids get affected by this stuff quite heavily. So I would definitely make sure you read up on your pals. So what I did was too, PediStat, right? I told all the docs, put PediStat on your phone, right? At the end of the day, when you start, if you're already fumbling through things and you're already nervous, just defer back to PediStat. It'll put the weight in and it'll spit out everything you need and go from there, right? And that's exactly what they did. They all downloaded PediStat and we were good to go, so. Yes, sir. They don't want to give it to us. We have to order our own.
I think the biggest challenge I had was going from, but over my deployment, I was inside of a hospital, and that's where I trained at. I did fellowship out at UMC and Dallas Air Force Base, so I trained in trauma bays and emergency departments. On the 26th, we had our first Marine come in, and he was very sick. And unfortunately, despite our efforts, he was a casualty. At that point, I went outside to assume my role in the triage bay. And I kind of went from being an indoor cat to an outdoor cat. And I had to practice medicine outside on the ground without oxygen, without suction, without nurses to help. So it was my first time really just working with corpsmen with stuff that was laying on the ground next to me. And I remember that challenge being like, well, this guy, because we had one Marine that was on his side in the recovery position that was going to lose his airway soon. So I was immediately like, this guy needs suction. And he had terrible wounds to his face and jaw. But suction wasn't an option. So we put him on his side and we started spooling the blood out of his mouth. And I tried to take a 60cc syringe with a 18-gauge catheter on it to suction out of his mouth and quickly learned that doesn't work. But luckily, I was able to waved down our DCCS, the Colonel Bruce Lynch, who got the Marine inside and he was taken care of inside. We avoid doing a crike outside. But I immediately went from that scenario to reevaluating the other patients we had. They're already categorized. And we use the NATO system. So there's your T1 that go inside right away, T2 that would be like our delay, and T3 would be minimal. So I was making my way through the T2s and T3s because the T1s had special operators and other foreign surgical teams taking care of them outside. So I felt I was best utilizing readdressing tourniquets, going back through primary and secondary surveys. And while I was doing that, it was incredible to me what was in our T3 and minimal areas. Like, there was a young girl, probably, like, she looked like an American 12-year-old, so she was probably like an Afghan 16 or 18-year-old, but very medium-sized with penetrating trauma to her abdomen. And when I pushed on her abdomen, it was rigid, hard as a rock, obviously peritonitic, and she yelled at me, screamed at me. And this young girl didn't go to the OR for 6 more hours. So you can understand the mechanism of injury that day that our people went through. She was back in the T3 area, which would be walking wounded if we were at an air show and something happened, right? So the biggest challenge for me was saying, okay, Travis, she would be a T1 back in the States, but right now she's a T3. So reassess, do what you can, and eventually she'll get the care she needed. Same thing with the airway patient that was losing his airway quickly. He was T2, and there was people in front of him that were T1. Because of the panic I had, and probably not enough field experience, honestly, because if I was a field-trained medic, I probably just would have criked him, and maybe saved a bed inside for someone else, we got him inside. So the challenge I've dealt with since then is kind of accepting what I failed at as far as not acting sooner with him and realizing where I can improve as a provider.
The original question, your most unexpected challenge.
Yes, there was a major one. Again, and that this reflected kind of the bigger picture of the entire process, because we were already multiple days into the evacuation at this point, and actually had moved people pretty quickly. by the 26th from where I was, as opposed to earlier in the operation. But when we were doing our plan-to-plan again, we had a bunch of medical equipment that we had on the flight line, along with the rest of the Marine stuff, that was going to fly into Kabul from Saudi Arabia, where we were, for the deployment. And fortunately, one of my nurses, as we're getting ready to go, because they said, okay, don't worry about it, your equipment will fly in right after you. One of my nurses is like, let's grab all of our scalable stuff out of that QuadCon, which was fortunate. It was Bella, who Christina Polk and I deployed with at our prior deployment. And fortunately for her foresight, and again, just being anxious, she's like, I don't have a good feeling about this. Let's just grab our stuff. And because we had been practicing being scalable and utilizing smaller teams, we had very limited but some medical equipment when we showed up. And in the true Navy fashion, as the Admiral had pointed out, we did beg, borrow, and steal. Highlight steal from the roll, too. And also from the 24th MU, who was located in North Ichkaya at the terminal, some of their equipment. Unfortunately, the 24th MU came on the morning of the 26th and said, we want our stuff back that you stole from us because we're about to pack up and go home. So on the day of the mass casualty, in that evening, it was around 5:30 at night, we only had one canister of oxygen, one monitor, one vent, one suction. And we've got four pretty sick casualties right off the bat. I mean, two were airways that were able to, if you just position them, they'd be okay. Kind of like the one you had mentioned initially, at least. One that was like a penetrating injury to the arm. And then the fourth one, which was this very sick gentleman. So, again, resources that we didn't have. I mean, the pediatric stuff was huge earlier on in the mission, and we had kind of made up some field-type care for babies and children for the evacuees because there was a lot of medical care that happened prior to the mass casualty that we tried to keep from the roll, too. You guys were getting inundated, so that's actually one of the requests they had for us was, could we start seeing those patients? But the lack of care, the lack of supplies that we had available to us at our site for the mass casualty, we were working out of our backpacks, which fortunately I had phenomenal faculty and mentors, some of which that are in this room, during my residency about, you know, making sure that you're able to be scalable and make sure your backpack has your, you know, O2 sat and all these other things that you need. And we ended up working out of those. The additional piece was the human resources. So T1 had asked us to push our ambulance, which again, we were only a quarter mile, but pushed one of our ambulance with some en route care resources down to the gate in response to the increased threat level the night before the mass casualty. So I actually split my team, and our teams were kind of doing Q24-hour shifts with one nurse on each team. Myself, the other ER doctor, we actually just lived at the roll one. We didn't really go back. And the team that was off was actually helping out with the ambulance triage at the time. But I only had three corpsmen and one other ER doc, myself, at our roll one during the actual mass casualty. My team that was at Abbey Gate was a nurse and three corpsmen, and they were actually triaging at the gate doing that mass casualty at point of injury. But again, not having a nurse, again, there's some faculty that are here that told me, as a resident, you may not have a nurse. Get used to you know, doing your own vitals and being comfortable just doing the nursing procedures, and that was definitely the case. So those were two huge things. Resources were incredibly limited for this particular region and the type of teams that I had for such a large number of casualties.
I'd like to take this opportunity. I have some more questions. I'm sure you've had enough silly time of questions with me, but wanted to open it up to the group here. If there's any questions or comments from the audience?
Just assaulted myself. I'm Mindy. I'm one of the third-year residents at Madigan. First, I wanted to thank you, sir, for kind of asking that question before as, like, one of the more junior physicians here and, like, someone who's just about to graduate. It's really encouraging to have male leadership actually acknowledge the fact that women do have, you know, obstacles, although they might be like unseen, but it's just an additional burden that we carry. So I appreciate that. But kind of along that line, I'm going operational next year. And I kind of wanted to see if you guys had any advice for, not just as a female, but as just like a junior medical officer, when you're having conflict with your chain of command that may not be medical, and kind of how you stand up for yourself, how you stand up for your medical team, the needs of the mission of yourself and your medics in line with, you know, the rest of the unit that's not medical. Because it sounded like, Dr. Landa, that you alluded to that there was, you know, disparities in your vision of moving forward. So kind of like that.
I think the key piece is coming back to being able to speak that operational language. But even if you can't do that, if you can put your potential patients, if you can put those people first, if you can say, I think this is a risk because of X, Y, and Z, or I recommend this because I'm concerned about, if you can phrase it in the way that you are concerned about their soldiers, Marines, sailors, airmen, if you can phrase it in that way, even if you can't speak the language, that should come across. Now, that being said, I have lots of other things we could talk offline about, which is also about, you know, decreasing the emotionality of things. So you can state your concerns without actually getting emotional about it, because at the end of the day, the operational commanding officer, the line person, what they say goes, right? So you can have these conversations, but know at the end of the day, their decision is their decision. So I did have this kind of like back and forth, but I also acknowledged that, sir, if you want me to be there, and this was at an AAR, it's an after action report for a exercise we had done that this came up. Said, if we do this and you say you need to be at the role too, I will go there. But if you don't tell me that, I'm going to do what I think is right. And he was like, well, whatever you think, doc. And that was that. But again, taking the emotionality out of it and putting your future patients first is probably the best way that I've learned to deal with any type of leadership challenges. And that's on the line, and that's also even in the MTFs as department head, same thing. If I could explain it in a way that I was concerned about future patients and actually describe why and what risks I was seeing, that always seems to at least help you in your mission to be the best physician you can to these people. Did that answer your question?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you.
Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Dane Davis. I'm with Zoll Medical. I'm a former Navy guy, but I converted Coast Guard and ended up retiring Coast Guard. I do work with Zoll Medical, and a couple of things that have hit me. I've been in this role. I'm a paramedic by trade, and the first thing I want to say is that as a paramedic, we strongly believe that everything starts and ends with physicians. We can't practice without your signature, and at the end of the day, when we have a critical patient, we're bringing them to you. So to us, it's all about you. And I, as the Admiral said, who better than you? And I say that to bring up two other points that the captain in his presentation a little while ago talked about: the devices where the monitors failed, the batteries failed, other kinds of significant equipment issue failures, as well as with Dr. Fontenot talking about the options of, you know, folks weren't exactly comfortable with the, possibly with some of the settings on doing ventilation, whether that's pediatric, adult, whatever the case may be. I say all this because I want to bring to you a resource that we're here for you. Zoll Medical right now, our ventilators, our aspirators, our monitors, our defibrillators, they're four of five very critical things that you all carry in field medicine, role one all the way through to the MTFs. There's seven of us on our team that our whole goal and role is we're very passionate about coming out and ensuring your readiness and your training. It doesn't cost you a dime. All you have to do is reach out to us. We will come to you. We go everywhere. We could see you in Korea. We could see you in Japan. We can see you here in the States, anywhere. And I know some of you were here to hear that earlier, but I know we didn't have all the room. After hearing some of these other stories, and I want to say that we do get calls a lot with people in the field that have had what could be a catastrophic failure on their equipment, but was actually very preventable and very simple if they would have looked at it on the forefront. And I say that to you as the physicians, use us as a resource to come help you and your teams. All you got to do is call us. We're here to help. Thank you.
Don't touch that equipment when you're in every hospital. So every hospital, every ICU, every
Are they not? Right? I mean, you just, we're in the field, you look at it, you're like, oh, that was my class. So they have a different insight, a different way of looking at it. The biggest thing we can do is grab a six pack and sit around and actually articulate it and let it out. Once it's out there, things, that's the things you need to do this again. But if the driver stood up there and said, I got apologetically in the because you don't talk about it. So let's talk. We're not going to get rid of gender issues. Right? And yes, there are some disadvantages. But oh my God, you have some advantages. Don't pretend it's just this. But please, let's take care of each other. Let's talk. I shit you not. When you talk to people upright, they're saying it's going to change the pressure. But it's, short, but I'm like, that one I looked up.
I mean, for everyone, for everything. Put it over the counter, honestly.
He had a question over here.
Oh, yes.
To follow those two comments, first, thank you for sharing your personal experiences, because it's less than a year ago, and so we appreciate that. So there's a lot of discussion on pediatric or lack thereof interventions and training, and you know we're all in charge of resuscitation. My question is more in the operative management, the damage control surgery. Did you all see any barriers to treating pediatric surgical patients at your location or even post-op surgical patients during the actual, you know, intervention, during the operative intervention, whether orthopedic or general surgical. And then I have a follow-on.
Yeah, so by the time they made it to us in Ramstein, Larmsey, if they were, like, there was one kiddo, I think he was like 5 years old, pretty severe traumatic brain injury, intubated. Like literally when that kid landed at Ramstein, he was airlifted in a helo off base to Hamburg. So, I mean, they were moving those kids pretty quick out of there if they needed something more definitive. Because obviously we didn't have like a pediatric neurosurgeon and all that stuff at Larmsey. So as soon as that kid landed, I mean, within like an hour or so, he was on a helo gone. So they moved him pretty quickly. That was the only severe trauma one that I had. The rest of them were all medical. So,
so we had, I think there's at least three pediatric X-labs that were done at the Roll 2. And our, I mean, our surgeons, I didn't hear of any complications, and all those kiddos end up getting transferred out without any big issue. And in the recess bay, we're really blessed to have EM physicians that also moonlight and do like the teaching agreements between civilian hospitals. So they see pediatric patients outside the base. So when it came to resuscitation of a pediatric child in hemorrhagic shock, it wasn't something new, or they weren't on their back foot. They were able to do it. My doc, Eric Mozaleski, put in a pediatric central line like in 30 seconds. Like, and I think that that's a really a big testament for the active duty folks. Like, and if you're at BAMC or if you're at like Tripler or the other bases that are seeing a big patient population, you probably don't need it as much. But the smaller institutions, I think you can't beat the training agreements with local hospitals and getting your docs. And hopefully someday the mid-levels, the PAs, can also get out and do some of that stuff as well. But to answer your question, sir, the damage resuscitation surgery and the recess and the trauma areas for pediatric patients, as far as I know, went well.
Great. And were there any Army FRSTs or FSTs at your locations?
Yeah, so we closed Bagram 20 June, went to HKIA, and we joined a Army FRST, I believe they're the 975th or 973rd, which was a half of their team. The other half was in Kuwait or Beering. Then the other half joined them. And then after the 15th of August, when stuff started to go belly up, half that team retrograded and the other half stayed there. So there was half an FRST with us, as well as a bunch of other special operations, conventional, and partner nation surgical teams. I think the final number was around 8 or 9.
Just a quick question. So if I understand this correctly, and I think I do, so we had Marine combat lifesavers who handed off patients to a Navy Roll 1, who handed off patients to an Army Roll 2 that were evacuated out of country by an Air Force CCAT team. So my question for the group is, had you met each other beforehand? Had you ever had a training opportunity between the services? And if not, where are our gaps and our blind spots?
I hadn't met anyone that we came into contact with from any of the other services. I think we all just kind of meld and kind of went from there, but I had never met any of the other folks that handed patients off to us. So.
No, there were no joint trainings, even the planning for it. A lot of the planning that was involved prior to going in was very COVID-focused rather than actually mass casualty. I kept asking for a mass casualty plan. It was just North HKIA. And I was like, well, that's not the whole base. I don't think we're going to be there if we go there. So there's none. And actually, it's going into my talk. So thank you, Captain Deaton, for bringing that piece up. But yes, more to follow. It's a huge lesson learned is that we do need to do a lot more joint, integrated, big picture planning from the top down would be helpful so that we're not just throwing things together. Now, that being said, I think the teams worked well together for the most part, especially for you guys over at the Roll 2. It was phenomenal. Obviously, there's always some friction when you've got new forces coming in and we're trying to move people over there. And who is this? And why is this? It was chaotic. I mean, that was clear on the news, I'm sure. And on the ground, it was certainly exactly that. But yes, it would be a great place to start, especially when we were at Committee for TCCC, for example, the mass casualty piece for that, building that out. And again, this is kind of alluding to my talk on Sunday, which is we need to target how we actually work as a purple force on mass casualty planning and prolonged casualty care, all these other pieces that are huge.
So I think part of this, and I think this is what GSA said is one way to do this. There are certainly other organizations and other ways to bring people together. But we've got to show up and step up and have to be at the table. Because if you're not at the table, you're not making the decision. So now you can't have any impact. You certainly can't complain if you've never even tried to sit at the table. But use these opportunities to sit down, meet the Navy, meet the Air Force, meet the Army people. Like, you're all very smart, right? And so make these connections. Start working through these things. There's no reason to reinvent the wheel. And so, again, we're here as GSA staff, but like whatever my capacity is and wherever I work, if I ever can help in any way, if there's a problem, it's probably already been dealt with. Maybe the Army hasn't dealt with it. Maybe just fought this 2 years ago. So this is the value of the military, right? It's a huge family. You can take people that have never met one another, never worked before, and it happens, right? You know, I've heard Dr. Pettit, you were talking about this. That uses when I brought you in. Like, individuals you never meet until 2 seconds before, you're now running mass casualty together for the finisher for 20 years. And that is the military. So use these opportunities to get to know each other. And then also use GSA staff or use whoever your friends are at, reach back and say, hey, I need help. I'm having this problem. How can we solve it? And get smart people in the room and come together to fix that. And the other thing I'll just say to kind of
blog here about the table is we met Adam Hancock had talked about leadership and being that person and being that doctor that's going to make the change. You've got to take those roles, because if you don't take them, other people will, and then do policies that if you don't like are not the best people to make those policies. So just going to put a plug in to kind of maximize your time this weekend. Take advantage of the fact that we're finally not behind a Zoom screen, and get to know each other, because you never know when you're going to end up on a flight line or a FOB or a ship. Apparently, I'm very afraid. I think I need to become a better swimmer after this morning's talk. But you just never know where you're going to run into these people. So
I think, and one of the things that I think frustrated a few of us is that once we noticed that we were moving a lot of sick kids, we had an Air Force pediatric intensivist that was deployed, and she was at Djibouti, right? And she's a CCAT, right, with the special ops folks, right? And I was like, well, she's not going to be used there. We could definitely use her here, right, to transport some of these really sick kids back to the States with these long flights. And so, I mean, we tried and tried and tried, and they would not let her go. Like, her leadership would not release her. I'm like, well, that doesn't, like, she literally, there has not been a CCAT mission at that spot in 18 months. It ain't gonna happen this weekend, I can promise you. So I'm like, let her go and let us use her where she can actually be used. They were not. Her leadership specifically told her, don't ask again. We're not letting you go. Yep. And I was like, this makes zero sense to me. Zero sense to me. So it's just those things that are just so frustrating. I mean, we kept trying to push it up higher and higher. Even the AE folks got involved because it was like, this just makes sense. Just bring her here. We could obviously use her. They would not let her go. Nope. Actually, they finally they redeployed the whole team back home because their deployment had ended. And she was like, I'll extend. And it was like, no, I mean, it's time for you to go home. And they would not release it. That was just so frustrating, so frustrating. Like, we have these amazing resources all over the world. And she works, she worked in the unit in BAMC. So she was like, I see kids all the time. And this is what we do. I'm like, why do we have to jump through so many hurdles when we have this resource that's readily available already in theater and just won't release it? Like, that's crazy to me. So
there was no layover in H. Kaya on her way back.
Yeah.
I don't know how I got on this plane and I ended up here. I mean, I'm stopping here on my way back to Texas.
I think that's the question. Yeah.
And this kind of goes back to more of the joint question. Captain, you alluded to there were some special medics and stuff available to you. When you're going into your Mass-Cal planning, did you know what resources you had available in the local area, both internationally as well as nationally, for like joint medical, 18 deltas, as well as what those resources are actually capable of?
Yes, ma'am. That's a great question. I actually I present on the triage system from HCAIA quite a bit. And the one, on my lessons learned for challenges, it's inter-service communication and planning. So when you, like, when we have a Mass-Cal and it's announced, it goes out over the loud voice, right, of a camp, and all your medical personnel show up. And when stuff started going crazy at HCAIA, we started getting a lot of units showing up. And so we had a little Mass-Cal practice one night where there was five people that were shot outside the wall. So we stood up all four trauma teams. So we technically just activated our Mass-Cal plan. And a bunch of bearded medics showed up, and corpsmen showed up that, you know, we hadn't interacted with yet. And a bunch of Army medics showed up. So we kind of started to get a gist. And, you know, we laid the groundwork. Hey, we'd like to talk to you guys so we can talk about planning. Well, that didn't happen because we were seeing so many traumas every day. Leading up to the 26th, then the 26th happened, and obviously you hear a big kaboom, and Mass-Cal goes out. Every medic on that base is going to go and help out at the roll too. And so what that turned into was at least 40 to 50 medics. And I say medics, but it was paramedics, 18 deltas, SOCOMs, corpsmen, and then bearded physicians, I'm assuming, people that were wearing hiking clothes and had ultrasound strapped to their arm.
It didn't matter who they were, because you're like, I don't need to know who you are, just go.
I'm very appreciative they were there. But to answer your question, there wasn't a lot of planning for the 26th, just because the units weren't there yet. So the 15th of August happened, everyone started going. We started to figure out what our medical assets were, and there were plannings for, like, the Alamo and, like, where the fallback was going to be and where other teams could go. But ultimately, I personally didn't have oversight over every medical asset that was there. So when I was doing my planning for triage, the whole plan was to triage with what we had in the facility, because when we had practiced initially at the Roll 2 before stuff went crazy, we were told you're going to have what you have. Our medics are going to stay with the line side. And that didn't happen when push came to shove. The medics, once their job was done on the line, came and helped us. So... yeah, so if that answers your question.
No, it does, and it just goes to anybody else in the room that might find themselves in those special units or in charge of medics in the special units. Make friends with your FRSD, make friends with your MUs and everything. Make sure that they know what resources are there. Say hi beforehand, and the credentialing is, who cares about that? It's just making sure that you know what resources you actually may actually have.
Yeah. Wander around and make friends.
That's the key piece there. So that's basically what we did. We sent someone in because we weren't in the role two. We weren't working out of the role two, but literally sent someone in. My other cohort, Nikki Cook, I sent her ahead of time to go make friends, go say hi. This is us. We don't know where we're going to be. We're around. We'll be sending you people. Despite that, even when we were communicating in the days leading up to the 26th with them to send them patients, Afghan evacuees, there was still some friction because, like, who are you guys? And there were just so many different teams there that, depending on who you're talking to, which was never Travis, he was actually very kind every time we spoke with him on the phone, there was some push and shove with that for those of us that weren't actually at the role too, because they had their huddles and everything like that. The rest of us were kind of spread out because there was a special ops team over at Alvarado. The flight line's big, and we were kind of in the south part, and then there was the North HCAIA group, which is where the role two was. So that was a little different. And then you brought up communications. I just wanted to highlight that a little bit too. So within the role two, there were good comms. And I know the Air Force and the Army and then everything for CCAT, I'm sure that's great comms. But for those of us that were not there, comms was really difficult. So comms between medical units that are not attached, and especially because these aren't, you know, the same service at all, was incredibly difficult. So we went from the days leading up to, we didn't have cell service where I was located. I was in an old security building that was abandoned that I took from the Turkish military and converted into a clinic / recess area. And there was jammers right outside because it was a security building. So there's no cell, no Wi-Fi, which is what you guys were on, Signal. Yeah. And most operations, even for the operational side, was on WhatsApp and Signal. Right? So we have no comms with that. Fortunately, I had grabbed a couple Marines they had given me from 2-1 to have green gear between ourselves and 2-1. So I had comms always with them, fortunately. But as it went on, my comm Marines jerry-rigged a printer router into Wi-Fi to give us Wi-Fi to actually communicate with the role too. And that is the only way that we actually announced to you guys that there was a MassCal. It was actually a text message that we did on Signal. My first one was like same time that the MassCal actually happened because we got it right on the green gear. There's an attack on Abbey Gate, casualties pending. And then Nikki put one out, MassCal. And she got, when we're done with our patients, you know, 2 hours later, she's got these nasty grams from one of their trauma surgeons. Like, you can't announce MassCal. Like, well, we did. You had 58 people coming to you, you know, like, so that's kind of the friction too that you see between units that aren't actually attached or actually in the same structure or aren't working together on a daily basis. And then also the communication piece. So there was, I mean, we went through there was a time that a landline was working. We were able to call with just the evacuees, hey, we're sending a patient, blah, blah, blah. Nothing about the patient or the time or the location or anything like that. But yes, Signal and WhatsApp was the main source of communication. If you don't have access to that because you don't have Wi-Fi because you're not on North HKIA, that was an issue. So I was very fortunate to have these junior Marines that just seriously were heroes in their own realm.
Just real quick comment. So, Travis, you talked about the fact that, you know, you had all these people show up. Wonderful to have all those people show up. You and I talked a little earlier about, you know, blood use and making sure. It was great they showed up, but particularly in that region at the time, the TTPs that were out there, you guys weren't expected to get one. You were expected there was going to be at least three.
Yes, sir.
So there's a lot of danger in that emotional reaction, right, to people flooding to a problem. And that's where that discipline and that's where these relationships and understanding, where I applaud your work pre, but really there's got to be a lot of discipline there because you get hit, you get hit again. And early in the war in Afghanistan, one of the best TTPs they had was putting IEDs under dead bodies and shipping them in, and all of our medics would run out of there and flip them over, and now we had a big problem. But again, it's just one of those things where talk them through. I will say it the last time, and then I'm probably going to be leaving here, but nobody better to do this today, right, in this conference. But more importantly, when you go back, I mean, how many people that are currently at Fort Bragg have been to Lejeune? How many people at Lejeune have been to Fort Bragg? It's an hour drive, hour and a half. And I think the beer's cold in both places.
Thank you. I did want to ask about security. And so asking just in the resources that were available and how that was handled, and if that was one of those things that you could offload and have somebody address, or whether you need to interject yourself in ensuring that that was taken care of?
At which location?
I think that will look different in each of your components, and so if you could each address it, that would be helpful to us. Thank you.
I'll start at point of injury for my team that was there. The Marines themselves had security, so they were kind of taking care of that. At my location, it was just the corpsman, myself. That was it. And our comm Marines, which actually, when my comm Marine, Lance Corporal, showed up, I said, and we were riding outside, we were getting gas, there was all kinds of stuff. This is before the 26th. I was like, you are the most senior Marine here. So when it comes to tactical things, you are the man. And he was like, yes, ma'am. And he went to town making sure that building was secure, along with my corpsman too. But he took his job very seriously as a Marine, and I appreciated that a lot about him. And so at the time of the actual mass casualty, we also knew that there was intel for multiple blasts, and that was a little concerning, and so we weren't trying to go outside, but that being said, we're also trying to help offload patients that are coming to us to help out. So it was limited the day of the MassCal. Prior to that, we had Marines that were actually securing our building because we had a lot of evacuees trying to get in, which was a different situation completely.
For us, for security, the big issue was whenever we would fly 2HKIA or even head to Qatar to replace the CCAT team, we would always take the Ravens with us, right? So the Ravens would fly there with us, get on the plane with the Qatar team, and then they would then go forward to HKIA. So they always had security on the plane if they were going kind of into the actual area in and of itself. One of the other issues that we had early on was just there was so many evacuees that even we would have like a few patients on the plane, then the rest of the plane would just be filled with evacuees, right? So you just making sure one had done their sweeps and that everyone was as safe as possible was always a threat. But if we knew we were going actually into HKIA, then the Ravens would just get on the C-17 with us and just fly with us for security. So then we would land, and then they would go out and kind of spread about and do that thing on the flight line. And then right before we bundled up, they would all come jump back on the plane, and then we'll go back home. So we always had security. So.
Pre-15 August, there was a international military police on the base. It was a NATO base. Luckily, 310 from the 10th Mountain Division from the Army provided a lot of security for us from the period in between there and the Mass Cal. Once the perimeter started getting breached at HKIA, all Army resources from the 82nd, and that time, I think most of 110 had ripped out except for Joey Griggs and Sloan Kelly, which were two medical officers that stayed and helped us a lot during that two-week period. So it was the 82nd and the Marines that provided for base security. For the hospital itself, we had the Norwegian Defense Force medical folks, and they send people with personal defense weapons like little 5.7 submachine guns. So it was them that guarded the door and also escorted Norwegian civilians to the flight line, and then ourselves. So the day of the perimeter breach, a sergeant major from the Army came to us and basically looked at me and two Army medics and said, "Prepare to defend the hospital. Our guys are busy." So, which was very understandable because the flight line, if you haven't seen a picture of HKIA, has no fence between the civilian side and the military side. It's a run, and if you can do that 400-meter dash and you're from Kabul, that might mean you can get on a plane, and obviously the news showed that. So when the sergeant major told us that, we grabbed M4s and M9s. We put an ambulance in front of the door of the ER, which we then discussed is a bad idea if someone needs to get inside, they get shot. So we moved it, and we defended the hospital. Luckily, no one came, but we were essentially our security. Later on, before the 26th, there was an increased threat of suicide, vest IEDs. Standard protocol prior to the fall of Kabul was to call EOD. Turkish EOD and IMP EOD would search the patient. After that, it was on our staff. So myself, I remember these guys were burning stuff. They didn't have any bad intentions, but these Afghan civilians were burning some cans. Cans explode and pop, and they got some penetrating shrapnel to their bodies. So the lights are out at this point, the concrete overhang of the Roll 2. So you can't really see out there. We see cameras. We see guys coming up. They're Afghan locals. I step outside with one of my Norwegian nurses and ask, like, "What are you guys doing? We're hurt. We want to come inside, get looked at." Okay. So myself and I can't believe I can't remember her name, but we went over and strip searched a guy in a blast bunker with Sergeant Smith, who is a reservist from the Army. I asked him to stand by with his M4 away from us, but looking at his buddies while we were searching him before he came into the hospital. We did have those metal wands, but they just beep all the time, no matter what you're scanning, so it didn't really help. Luckily, that was the only time I had to pat someone down, but at that point, as like the triage person, after Sloan Kelly had left, who was another PA that was the main triage person during the actual Mass Cal itself, I did search people before they came into the hospital a handful of times. Luckily, nothing happened, but the security, for the most part, was self-provided outside of the Marines and the soldiers that were our primary security for the base, if that makes sense. So structure security.
So we've got about 10 minutes left in this discussion. I wanted to give you all an opportunity, if you have any, I know you have a talk on Sunday that you can get some more details, but if there's anything else that you would like to say to our group.
Yeah. Earlier today, when Captain Deaton talked about we're here for the service members, that's our job. It really, just remember that. Our job is to take care of service members when they get shot or blown up.
And I think the other patient demographic that we saw quite a bit of was OB patients, so much so that the Air Force actually deployed OB teams to be on all those flights. I mean, there were a lot of pregnant patients that we transported. And that was, I mean, and they were like very pregnant, right? I remember one that we transported, she was like G9, P whatever at 40 weeks with twins. I was like, man, we had turbulence, we were screwed, right? So I'm like, this is not going to be good. It's going to be horrible, actually. And she was probably like one of like five pregnant patients on the flight. I was like, what are we going to do with all these? Like, this is a lot of people. And so that was another issue, right? It's like, do we have OB kits? Like, I know we have a big procedure bag, but I don't know if there's OB kits in this thing. So now we have two patients, right? And so it's so all that, and now we need more blood, right? And so then when the OB docs got there, they were like, yeah, do you guys carry Pitocin? I was like, C-CAT, bro. Don't carry no Pitocin. What are you serious? Like, you don't get out much, do you? Like, it's like, we don't have that. No. Right? So you might want to go to LARMC and see if they have some of that stuff, right? So again, just talking to these folks that we've never deployed with, right? They don't know what we have. I did not know what was in the backpacks they had. So we had to come together and just kind of do like a sharing session of like, okay, what are you guys actually flying on the back of the plane with? And then how can we from C-CAT better assist you, right? And if mom does deliver, right, I'll take the baby and you make sure mom's okay. And then once you make sure mom's okay, if mom has any airway issues, then I'll step in and help with the airway issues. And then we'll all make sure the baby's okay, right? But we had to plan before it was time to actually go out and do the mission, right? And so again, you have all these teams that have never, ever worked before. And this OB doc, the two we had, they'd never flown before. They'd never deployed before. So this was, the deployment in and of itself was new, right? That experience was new. And then now you throw all of these pregnant patients at them that they have no idea what their like prenatal history was, right? And so now they're trying to find all this information out, and it was just, so the pregnancy and the OB piece was pretty robust for us as well. So flexibility.
Those weren't casualties. Those were from the evacuation. Yeah. I'll save most of my other comments for my talk, but kind of piggybacking off this, because we're not really talking about the evacuation piece, which in itself was huge before the Mass-Cal. A lot of pregnant patients, and I just want to put a large value on making sure you have your ultrasound. I love that you said there were these bearded guys with ultrasound shouts them, because mine was in my grenade pouch. I had a butterfly ultrasound that I had purchased myself prior to deployment, and that was phenomenal, especially because we had just so many patients that were pregnant that would come to us in the days leading up to the mass casualty. In fact, there was a day that there were, no kidding, 11 pregnant ladies waiting outside to be seen by us. And these are women that never had prenatal care. These are women that didn't know how pregnant they were, and one of them had a placental abruption, and there's no OBGYN there. Fortunately, there was an Afghan OBGYN behind me with her father who needed insulin, which, again, we didn't have, but we borrowed from someone else who had it. That's another story of the cowboy medicine that went down. So anyways, we were able to kind of source some of these things from the Afghans themselves, and this lovely, lovely Afghan OBGYN agreed to go to the role two to kind of help facilitate planning or delivery if it needed to happen for this 27-weeker with a placental abruption that I'm like, that doesn't look right on my ultrasound. That was something else beforehand that we kind of ran into. But again, a lot of incredible just trying to make things work in the days leading up to it was just something that no one could have been prepared for unless we had all the equipment that we could ever desire at the time. But the pediatric stuff, the OB stuff, that was all stuff that doesn't come in your STP kit, right? It doesn't come in your combat trauma. It's all stuff I was like, the first day, like, can I make an IO out of an 18-gauge for a baby? Because they were throwing babies over the fence. And in fact, the location I was at, I wanted that location, one, because it was told I needed to be in that proximity, but two, a corpsman from 1-8 basically had a dead baby, had a baby that died in his arms at that location at the East Gate the night before. So if no other reason, I said, if there's nothing happens to the Marines, thank goodness, that's amazing, but I want to be here for the corpsmen, because in this situation, they are not trained to take care of pediatrics or non-trauma, and a lot of these Afghans had like dehydration, seizures, hypoglycemia, just complete exhaustion. They've been trampled on their way into the gates. They've been assaulted on their way into the gates. And then there was, you know, the infectious issue around us with diarrhea and human feces everywhere. It was beyond anything you can imagine. at those gates. And so just knowing that you may need to care for these things and keeping all those, you know, DNVI skills, like Admiral Hancock and Captain Deaton both mentioned, those are huge issues that we need to not only know how to do ourselves, but like Captain Deaton had said, is pass on to our nurses, pass on to our corpsmen, because, yeah, a lot of these corpsmen and even CLS Marines were taking care of a lot of the patients before they ever even came to us or to you guys. That's all I've got. Thank you.
Great. You know, listening to you all over the past hour and a half has been very enlightening and very much an honor to hear what you all have done. I think what is amazing to me listening to this is all of you are emergency medicine trained, and I think that willingness and ability to kind of think outside the box and think in your feet is something that we pride ourselves in our specialty, along with being military medical officers. And so I want to applaud your efforts of, you know, making work what you have, reacquiring objects from other places. Supply sergeants are the best friends you can find to make things appear when there are none. So really, you know, thinking on your feet, saving lives. And also what else I heard throughout this conversation was that taking care of yourselves, but also taking care of your others, looking out for your colleagues, your medics, your corpsmen, you know, it is really inspiring to hear. So again, thank you all for talking about this topic, and thank you everyone here for your thoughtful questions. So our next lecture is going to start at 15:20, which is in 15 minutes. So I'll see everyone back here at 15:20.
GSASEP is proud to be the premier continuing medical education source for military and federal emergency physicians. To purchase CME for the episode you just listened to, please click on the link in the show notes. The Government Services Chapter of the American College of Emergency Physicians promotes quality emergency care and enhances the development of emergency physicians who serve our nation from training through retirement. Learn more about our chapter at www.gsacep.org.